Welcome to Forward. I'm your host, Allison Innes. It's hard to believe that this episode marks the beginning of our fifth series. Thank you to all of you who have been with us since the beginning. And if you're new here, welcome. I invite you to check out our ever-growing back catalog of interesting interviews. Forward is a podcast that introduces you to the wide, wonderful world of humanities through interesting conversations with students, professors, and researchers here at Brock University. Over the past series, we've explored issues as diverse as opera, misinformation, trauma, masculinity, luxury, video games, and even food. This series will be continuing that eclectic mix of topics you've come to expect, but we'll also be introducing some new episode formats as well. After the success of last series' tour of Mackenzie Chown Complex, we have more on-location interviews planned for you. Our first episode this season is recorded on location at the Visual Arts Gallery at the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts. The gallery is a teaching exhibition space that supports coursework and creative work by visual arts undergraduate students with special exhibits by faculty members and community artists. Our guest this episode is Dr. Linda Carrero, a visual artist, professor, and associate dean of fine and performing arts in the Faculty of Humanities. Linda is an interdisciplinary artist whose work uses text in sculpture and printmaking. Her work has been exhibited across Canada and internationally in solo and group exhibitions. Her awards and honors include, most recently, the 2021 Massey Visiting Scholar at Massey College, the University of Toronto. She's a Bachelor in Fine Arts from the University of Manitoba, a Master's in Fine Arts from the University of Alberta, and a PhD from Cardiff School of Art and Design. Dr. Carrero showed us around her recent show, Afterthoughts, which was exhibited in the Visual Arts Gallery in September. The show explored her ideas and thoughts about mortality, and I'll let her explain. So I will just say welcome to Forward.
Okay. We are actually standing in the Marilyn I. Walker exhibition space, and it is used by faculty, students, alumni, and sometimes community members who can apply or who are invited to have exhibitions here. And so the space is quite typical of a white cube, as they would call it. It's slightly more rectangular than that. And right now, the works that are housed in that space are actually a series, a body of work that I worked on basically from May through till the installation in August, and carved out time. So it's been a series that's a long time thought. So it's been ruminating, and I've been thinking about how to approach it. And just in terms of, you know, before I get there with this specific series, I guess it would be just important to kind of note that for probably the past 25 or 30 years, I have been working with words. And words are sort of the main object, in a way, in my work. I used to be a figurative artist, and I worked in kind of trying to create narratives, so positioning the figures within a setting and using sort of props and setting kind of a mise-en-scene and getting people to kind of connect the dots between one of the pieces and the next, and then kind of creating the whole storyline. So each of them were sort of chapters. I was finding it very limiting in a way, because the figures, even though I was always trying to pose them so that their gestures had meaning, the relationship, how far apart they were positioned, if they were alone, if they were in a group, the eyes, the gaze at the viewer, what coloration in the scene, was it blue, was it red, was it kind of ochre, which is a sort of a, illness or jaundice. Those things started to become tropes for me, and I was very disinterested. So I actually started a body of work on my self-portrait, using my own body, my self-portrait, and doing them in charcoal with a fluid kind of asphaltum, which had wax in it, which made it really, really fluid, so I could almost do these painterly works with charcoal.
And what's asphaltum?
Asphaltum is actually what you use to pave the roads, but we use it in printmaking to lay down a ground so that when you actually pierce through the ground with a needle and then put it in an acid bath, the acid goes into the places where you've pierced through with a needle, and those etchings become the thing that prints when you run it through a press. So I started to then play with using words in conjunction with these outlines, and thus a series arrived that I was so much more interested in because I was specifically playing with words that had multiple meanings and could be interpreted in different ways. At some point, I then just divested myself of the figures and used only the words, but I still very, very much connect the words with the human body and the human form. And not just mine, but the viewers, because I want the words to be able to be experienced not just as a set of, you know, texts that are positioned, but also how they're positioned on the format. I always use paper. Sometimes they're sculptural. I often use really fragile paper that looks like it's going to fall apart, or materials that call attention to themselves and their application. The physicalities are really important because it's a reminder of the body of the maker, but I also position them so that the viewer has to move around as they're reading the words, what I call choreogrammatics. So it's making meaning through the words, and the more you spend time with words, the more the meanings open. So pluralistic engagement can kind of occur. So, for instance, one person who was reading some of my works started to read it over and over and over again and started to really interpret it and reinterpret it and then interpret it more emotionally. But then it got to the point where she saw her gestures as exclamation points, commas, and periods. So she was almost seeing her body as creating punctuation by how she was reading it over and over again. So I'm aware that some people walk by and not read the words at all. But those who do engage, because there's shadows, because there's edges of the paper, in this particular series, there's lots and lots of sort of ink washes that are applied in different ways. The hope is that reading opens up to all kinds of materials, physical, sensual attributes, and not just the words and how I've positioned the words.
So as the viewer here, visitor here in the gallery, so what I'm seeing is I'm seeing across the long wall of the gallery a series of paper banners, different shapes and sizes hung at different levels. Some are kind of white with a splash of color, some are like fully colored, and they all have words on them. So do you want to take us, guide us through the piece and how to read it?
So essentially the words in this series is one, as I say, of about, you know, 25 years of working with words. Often they were words that were appropriated from other texts or sort of, you know, snippets of text. But I've been over the last several years really inspired by Roland Barthes' The Pleasure of the Text. And he actually talks about the grain of the vowels, the patina of consonants. And so in some ways I'm trying to evoke the sensuality of words, and not words as something that's placed on the paper as an authoritative, this is it, this is what this means, but being very aware that they have associations, connotations, and those are personal, cultural, societal, and so it's going to mean that it's not going to have the same meaning for everybody. Mm-hmm. This particular exhibition is kind of resonant because it is following after the pandemic, but it's also following the death of my own father a few years ago and my father-in-law a couple of years ago. And the kind of impact of the loss of those people, but also being very aware then of my own mortality. So the show is called After Thoughts, and it literally is thoughts, my thoughts about the afterlife. And I think even when I go back as a child thinking about trying to imagine being raised as a religious person and no longer being there, trying to imagine what's heaven like, you know? Is there an all-you-can-eat buffet? How do they feed all those bodies? You know, so going in that direction, but then recognizing the thoughts that I've had about the afterlife for many years. Really, right, growing up and now as an adult. So this series, I would say, should be seen as a sort of series of extracts rather than, you know, a sort of summing up of, oh, I have an epiphany about what death is. I don't, because I have never been dead. But it's sort of thoughts that I've had. I really wanted, initially, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to make it very full of fear and dread and really emotional and confessional. And at some point I recognized by constructing the sentences that it's indescribable. You can't actually describe it. And so I also like that the words are that. They're simply extracts. They have meaning to me. They may not have meaning to other people, but they are in a way have that intangibility that we see when we talk about the afterlife or death. In this particular series also, for the past 20 years or so, I have been carrying around a bottle of vintage Waterman's ink, blue-black ink, probably from the 30s or 40s. And because of its age, it actually has some particles that are a little bit dry that settle at the bottom. So even when I shake it and add it to new inks, there's a kind of reticulation that occurs like when I apply it. Exactly, that's exactly. There are these grains, and so the way that they pool are a little bit unsettled. They don't pool as a beautiful inky sheen. I'm very aware that when I was using them, that there's this almost like a virus or a tainting or a kind of a pollution, which for me equated a little bit to a sort of decay or disease.
So when you put the ink on the paper, are you manipulating the paper or the ink in a way to kind of get these larger, like to get it to spread out and to cover larger areas?
Both. So the way that the series is done is I made my own stencils with a reusable vinyl, and then I laid the text down. I also had some studio assistants who were helping me lay down the text. And thinking about how the words are positioned and the phrases that I use. And then I start with either brushes, but then I've often used sponges because I love the kind of swooping strokes that the sponges could have. There are other pieces where I have layered and layered and layered. I think this one is, it says, after, 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 but soon and yet not yet, which is a phrase I've used a couple of times in relation to thoughts about death and dying. And this one you can actually see is layered and layered and layered. Ink is really unforgiving. In other words, you put it down and that's it. Even if you add water, there's always a trace there. And I love, too, that it's kind of a reference to Jacques Derrida's and the erasure, which means if you put a word down, even if you extract it, there's a residue of that word. It can't be unsaid or undone. And so ink is really great for that because you really do put it down, it makes a mark, and then you have to either go over it. You can try and sponge it off, which is what I did with this one, where you've got these kind of sweeping circles where I realized it was much too dense and I wanted to try and pull back. But essentially it's quite unforgiving. So if I could pour it, I could manipulate it with paper, I could use sponges and brushes. It had a lot of its own doing, and in a way, when you're working with something like ink or asphaltum, which I mentioned earlier, you have to be open to the fact that you're not going to fully control it. You have to give up some of the control, and you actually have to find a way to dance with the media.
And that's a really interesting choice with your theme here,
yes.
The idea of control. As you were speaking, I was starting to think about, okay, so you can't really control the ink, but thematically, you're also engaging with something that is beyond our control as well, which I think is really interesting, that resonance between the medium you've chosen and the message you're conveying.
That's exactly right. So this kind of understanding, and even there were some of these pieces where I'd think, oh, that's just the point I want it. That's just where I want it. I'm going to leave it and I'm going to let it dry. And I would come back overnight and I don't know if it was the ventilation or, you know, something. But then I'd come in and it had pooled in a different way. And I find that kind of, that the materials have a huge part of the meaning. I find that really important in the way that I use my work. The other thing about this series is that I've often equated the spaces of the sea and outer space.
I was going to ask you about the color palette. I love this color palette. you've picked some of my favorite colors.
Oh, good.
but we're talking blues and blue greens and greens and like some of these, like this one in particular, after, I feel like I'm at Georgian Bay, looking down into the beautiful colors with the brown rocks shining through. There's very much a water and a nature vibe that you've got going on
here. Some people have said they look like sort of topographical maps or landscapes. I had a colleague come in and say some of them she felt like they were mossy or something rotting in the water, which I think all of those are accurate. But yes, for me, the idea of space, it's so infinite, it's so vast, we have no idea really what's out there. We haven't even scratched the surface, and we probably never will as a civilization. And so I think of that infinite unknown. And then I think the same about the ocean is we don't know what's down there. We can't actually get down to the depths of the sea, and we're starting to, but that whole vastness and strangeness of that world and of space and the unknowns of that, I equate to kind of facing the unknowns of the afterlife. We also can't live in those spaces without breathing apparatus, so they are spaces we actually can't inhabit in the human body without assistance. So in all of these, there is a reference to either kind of like being submerged in water, or this one, it says a drowning by stars and gases. This one, a lot of them, I think you were talking about how some of them are lots and lots of white space and others are almost impenetrable. And in Drowning by Stars and Gases, I really envisioned like the weight of this text.
It's all at the bottom.
So the text is all at the bottom, and then there's just this limited gestural marks that I used with a sponge. And then it just was exactly enough. It had that kind of weight at the bottom, and then the vacuousness, in a way, of all of the negative space or the white space. Then there's something like et cetera with an X through it. In other words, there is no et cetera. Like, it's done. But in this one, you can really see the how the ink created almost a patina. It almost looks like metal because of that Waterman's ink. There was quite a lot in this one.
Waterman's ink is in every color that you've mixed.
It is. So I've used some brand new inks, beautiful inks, fresh inks, but I always mixed in the Waterman's. And because it's blue-black, it had a tendency to gray things down. In this one particularly, you can see it has almost created a patina, almost like an erosion that's happening on the surface of it, which it is fantastic. That's the kind of the reason for using that tainted ink. I only have about an inch left in the bottle. I've been using it for 20 years, but never more so than this series. So,
and there's a very organic feel to it. Like that et cetera one personally reminds me of the rock that we're surrounded with here in Niagara.
Right.
That rough limestone with some lichen on it, and kind of that kind of texture to it, that graininess to it. And then as we talked about, like the water, the moss, like all of these other ones. And I think that's really interesting with your theme about decay and the afterlife. Mm-hmm. We are organic beings.
Exactly.
And so there is that organic element coming through. I wanted to ask you about the font.
Right.
And your choices, because obviously that's a deliberate choice.
It is, yes.
Was that a font you designed yourself? Was that a font that you pulled from somewhere else? And why this? Like, yeah. It's a beautiful serif font.
Yes.
Doesn't look quite Times New Roman to my eye, but I
right.
could be wrong.
It's not Times Roman. Okay. It's a footlight. And okay. I take a lot of time actually determining for each series. And in fact, I had that question about, do I change the font for each piece? Mm. And that was a consideration as well. And I did think about it more than once, or mixing and matching. But I decided I'm committed. I'm just going to go with this. And the reason that I use serif is because serif looks, appears, people perceive it, I guess is the way to put it. People perceive it as more grounded because it has a footer mm-hmm. and a header than a sans serif, which could be tipped over. That's, if you look at typography theory, Van Loon talks about that a lot. In my mind, the reason I use serif is that it has the perception of being more grounded, and yet because I'm using the materials around it in such a gestural, messy way, that it loses that sense of being grounded. So for instance, you can see in some of them, the ink pooled underneath the stencil, which mm-hmm. was hard to control, and I really enjoy that, actually, because it's almost like impregnating the words. The words become imperfect, and they become fallible and subject to things influencing, and I think that's exactly what I'm interested also in words, is that one word can be interpreted in different ways or has different meanings to different people or different subjectivities, I guess. And this one, I think, is the one that had the least amount of the Waterman's ink, actually. It's funny enough because, and it's so intensely aqua.
Bright, yeah, it's a very bright color. It kind of stands out from some of the others.
Yes. So this was because I got a new ink. I bought a new ink, an aqua ink. And it was like glory in a bottle. It was so beautiful. But to use it straight up was so intense. I've never used an ink quite that color. So I used water, but I also did use the Waterman's ink in there.
Yeah,
and
you
can see tiny particulate matter here.
Bits,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there is the tainting, and in fact, where it creeps under the O. And in this one, I really wanted that illumination because the phrase is, if we all become stars, at what point does the incandescence turn the night sky from dark to light? So you always hear, oh, we all become stars. And I thought, well, if all those millions of people have become stars, why is it still dark outside at night? I don't understand. So just playing with these different phrases, but in each one of these, I was trying to respond through color, through gesture, having the marks kind of resonate or reflect what I was trying to do with the phrase, and have them become obviously part of the content, right? Because in my mind, it's all connected. The words are content, the process is content, the reading is content, the materials are content, the shadow. All of this works together to create meanings, plural. In this one, I put the water opens and I am submerged in an inky vapor. And I was really trying to create an inky vapor, something that was vaporous. And you can really see the Waterman's ink and how it's pooled in so many different places. But then I actually took a cup of water and poured it back into the ink, and so you can actually see it starts to reach to where it says the water opens, and the water does actually open the words and start to actually taint the text, and becomes its own sort of almost echo of the phrase above it.
One thing that I noticed with the way it's hung, so I said, like, you know, they're hung along the length of the room at different heights, but they're also hung at different depths. And
right.
There's not really a clear order. Like, I want to read them left to right because I'm English speaking and that's how we read, is left to right. Mm-hmm. But when I'm kind of looking at it, I feel like I've got a lot of different thoughts coming at me. you know, it's like that opening movie scene with the star field coming towards you a little bit, with all these different thoughts coming, and as I kind of look at one, I see another one, and so I find I'm jumping around a little bit between thoughts, which I don't know about other people's brain, but certainly how things work in my brain, jumping from things to, you know, one thing to another. And you've got kind of these really deep and philosophical, but then you've got this lovely one that says, did I leave the coffee maker on?
Right. I love your analogy about the opening sequence and coming at you. And actually, I'm really happy to hear that read, because I was very conscious that people are going to try to make a whole narrative. They're going to say, okay, we start with this one and we end with this one, right? Because we do, in our culture, read left to right. But I see these as extracts, and one of the hardest things was actually figuring out the order of these so that I wasn't just doing, oh, here's these colors that look good together, or, oh, here's what I'm trying to say. In fact, I was trying to ensure that there was a kind of a point, counterpoint, and that these were just extracts, and pulled together, they form a kind of idea, but at the same time, I'm aware this idea continues. Like, it's not finished, it's not finite. But the words, again, they do evoke sometimes my sort of philosophical thinking about it, sometimes my just really anger at the idea of facing death, and sometimes this sort of cheekiness. Like, I thought, what if my last thought is, did I leave the coffee maker on? I'd be really disappointed if that's my very last thought on Earth.
But it's so, like, it's so mundane. It's so, yeah. It's so normal.
Yep.
You know, like... Yeah, leave for work. Did I leave X, Y, you know,
that's right.
X, Y, Z on or
yeah.
whatever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's very, very relatable kind of in that quotidian daily experience
right.
of life with these more philosophical thoughts. I just want to say I absolutely love the color in it. I'm like, can you bottle that so I can have that? That color, it's stunning. It's this beautiful blue color.
Well, it's another one of the new bottles that I bought. This one was called Teal, and I absolutely fell in love with it. It's just radiates. But when I put it on, you know, I thought, it doesn't read as ether other. It reads as really vibrant. And what does ether look like? I don't really know. But so this one actually has several layers, and the last one is actually a soft layer of white washed over to kind of make it look a bit more ethereal and not so articulated. But yeah, there's something amazing about the intensity of inks, and it's very new for me. I played with them. I did a series called Pandemic Perturbations, where I had my thoughts, and I was working on a small table with stencils because that's the only space I had during lockdown. And I had never really used ink before and became very interested in it. So that's where this started, thinking about using these on a large scale. And also countering the idea that when the conceptualists started to use text and to replace image with text, because they felt the abstract expressionists were becoming too gestural, too emotive, their idea was to use words as a kind of form of democracy so that words could be open and everybody had access to them. But the problem with that, or the flaw with that, is that not everybody has access to the words in the same way. Not everybody will access the same meaning from the words. And so I specifically bring back the expressive attributes, what I call messy gestures, messy text, and imperfect text, in a way so to draw attention to the fact that words do move, they're mutable, they're not fixed, either at a point in time by people and how they examine them, but also they change meaning over time, how we ascribe meaning to something.
So for non-artists who may be listening,
yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about kind of that artistic, like, we're seeing these beautiful images, and you know, you could have just gone in your studio, boom, done, boom, done,
right.
Boom, done. What's the kind of, tell me a little bit about the trial and error process.
Right.
Do you have like a stack of pages at home in the studio that just didn't quite measure up? What's the kind of, what's that behind the scenes that leads eventually to this very polished presentation?
Right. That's a great question, because we're often encountered by people who's like, oh, I'm an artist, and they paint on the weekend, and they've taken a couple of courses, or they, you know, and that's great, but art is really hard work, and some people may perceive it as therapy. I do know I don't feel quite right when I'm not in my studio enough, because I feel a compulsion to be in there. But there's a lot of research. So it started with creating sets of words, writing, rewriting, acknowledging I'm not a poet, but I wanted to write the texts myself, or they were pulled from other, you know, sources and recognizable. So that was the first, and then it's kind of composing where it's going to go. And then, because I do work, when artists work with materials year after year after year, they have a kind of a bodily knowledge of what is going to happen. There's more confidence with making mistakes, with taking risks, with pushing the materials. I did a series where I was working with fire, so I was printing the text with lemon juice and sugar, and then using candles and heat guns, and sometimes the words would actually start to ignite, and you'd get this great big hole, and sometimes I go, oh, that didn't work. Sometimes I go, yeah, that's perfect. That's the punctuation point I needed. And so it is getting to a point where you're working with materials, you're acknowledging they have a way that they work, and you're okay with working that. You have ideas, you're manipulating, you're working in a kind of gestural way, but also acknowledging that each material has a language as well and is contributing, but at the same time also saying, okay, I know this one, I want more negative space, the one and period. With just this small swoop of brushwork around it. It's a small statement, but by putting the period, understanding there is no more and. It'll be and done. And nothing. And so the idea of nothing around there being really important. So it's also understanding conceptually how these are working.
And
The composition, the negative space, the materials, how the materials were applied, the color, but it's interesting because I haven't really worked, I would say these would be considered abstract to many people, and they are abstracted gestures, but the text really being the focal point. And so I'm very curious because moving from a figurative background, a huge scale figurative, to these then large scale gestures, which are of my body and my figure, I'm sort of interested in how these have come along. So yeah, there's research, and yes, there's a pile of ones that did not make it into the show. Just, you know, they weren't working, they were too dense, they were flattened, or they had just no resonance. And some of them, I acknowledge, probably wouldn't work on their own, but because they're part of this larger dialogue, they fit in. They have a place because they're part of that extract.
So while you're working, it's thinking not just about this specific piece that you might be working on, but also kind of thinking about how you are shaping the larger one, and kind of how they're all going to literally hang together in the gallery.
Right. And the more time you spend in the studio, I mean, I think about the first one, which was the after, but soon and yet not yet. And the next two of them got discarded. This one was really, I put down the ink, and then I realized I need more layers on this, and then you have to let it dry overnight because it takes a lot of time to dry. So that one was a lot of layering, and it was something very different in a way than I envisioned. But at some point, I recognized there's something in there that I'm very interested in, and that does seem to kind of talk about tissue or sort of layers, or as you said, it's like a topography. But the other two, which were approached that same way, I felt they fell flat. They just became very, very dense. Something like the space equals death one was very, very dense as well. And I took a rag and just saturated it with water and then started to move over it, back over it, and remove it in these kind of sweeps. And it almost looks like metal now, mm-hmm. as if it's aluminum or something under there. So the qualities of the ink were, you know, really the color and the way that they pool was all very, very much related to this notion of the mess behind it, things that aren't perfect and can't be controlled. I think some people might also recognize this one, and I did decide that that one should be at the very right-hand side, which is, that's all, folks. And we all grew up with that terrible, terrible set of cartoons, actually. But some people might recognize...
They have not aged well.
They have not aged well. But certainly that phrase came to me. I was like, that's all, folks. And it's interesting because in the Looney Tunes, it should be that's all, comma, folks, exclamation point. But they don't have a comma. And so I was thinking about how really interested I was in it. It's like, that's all, folks, but also that's all, folks. In other words, all of us are going to be there. But then I made a small kind of a reference to the circles that the text goes in at the end of the Looney Tunes, those rings around the words, and then layered...
You got them right away? You were very successful with that because I recognized the words.
Yes.
And I saw those rings and I'm like, I know the reference. And it kind of gave it, after reading, again, some of these deeper philosophical, it kind of also gave it a little bit of a lift at the end. So you don't leave feeling really depressed.
Right.
or at least for me, it gave it a little bit of a like, well, in the end, it's the end, and we show's over,
that's
go
all
home.
Folks. Yeah, that's right. That's good.
Your colors here at this end of the shift are really interesting. We go from this beautiful green, very, very granulated green color, resting bones cured in water and salt, and then we have this stunning blue, thinking time backwards does not stop the outcome. But then we've got yellow, and this is the first time we see yellow. We have a little yellow dot under there, and then this stunning, which of course drew my eye immediately when I came in the gallery, this stunning yellow piece with little yellow bits on the floor.
Yes.
and then the text in That's All, Folks. I don't know if it's just my eyes or if it really is yellow, but it looks yellow.
I tinted it yellow.
Okay, you did tint it yellow.
I did,
okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about this yellow, bringing in this, I guess it's a somewhat complementary color to blue. So right. it really kind of stands out, and it, I suppose, emphasizes the blueness in some of your pieces. But like, why?
It's funny, I really, so it started with this idea of this, it's sort of like sheet of light illumination, this kind of really, really intense yellow, but also with washes throughout, which I then perforated myself and a couple of my student assistants, who were amazing, and perforating, sitting down for hours and perforating and feeling like you've barely made a dent in the paper. And it's almost like lattice work, but I also see it as kind of stars or particles under the sea. And then I collected the perforations that had been done and collected them in a cup. And so on the floor is the sprinkle of those perforations, almost like the fallen stars or the stardust or something. So those will be scooped up and kept again. It's funny, I did see actually over by the gallery entrance, there were a couple on the floor and I picked them up. So I'm sure people are getting close to look at the piece and then it gets stuck on their foot or whatever, their shoe, and they walk around. So,
and those holes, they're very random. And you've got a couple of different sizes going on there too. And then in some places you kind of have like a cluster of holes that makes a big hole.
Right.
In some places you have, so there is again that very organic, very natural kind of feel to it.
Right.
Like looking at a starry sky.
Right, right. And if anybody's been, you know, out in the country and seen the sky, it's almost like lattice work. It's so incredible. And what's really interesting about the yellow is that I had a colleague come and do a studio visit this summer, and I said that actually the yellow might not stay, that I was thinking I might actually tint it a soft green over top, and they were insistent that the yellow was really necessary, and I said, I'm really struggling with it, I'm not sure, and at the end, when I pulled it up and saw it through the window and all of the kind of light that came through it, I decided that I would actually kind of do a little quotation of the yellows. So that's all, folks. The white seemed too stark with it, so I just added a really, really pale yellow. And actually, thinking time backwards does not stop the outcome. There was a little perforation in the paper at the bottom, and I just felt I wanted to make a punctuation of it, of a soft yellow. And again, it's that sort of radiance of the stars, which I refer to, you know, in a couple of the other pieces. Yeah, so.
And speaking of the perforations and the light coming through it is a little bit hard to see, but you do, with the gallery lighting, you do see the shadow print on the wall, which
yes.
looks very lacy.
Yes.
And the pieces, again, I don't know how much of this was intentional and how much of it was a happy discovery, but the shadows themselves of these pieces with the different light sources and light directions creates a very kind of ephemeral echo.
Mm-hmm. Shadows are always really important in my work. I always pull my paperworks off the wall, whether I pull them out on nails and have cut text through it so that that word is repeated with the shadows on the walls. So shadows are important. And in this one, where I've have them at varying distances from the wall, and none of them are actually on the wall or even that close to the wall, it is the idea that the reader can come in and can find a space. They have to come here in order to read these, but then they turn their head and they may get a slice of that yellow perforated piece and the shadows on the wall, which that do look like lace. So,
and you almost come into the artwork to read it.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to move, and I think that's the choreogrammatics part of the work. This one, not as much as some of my previous pieces, where you actually have to either circumnavigate a piece or follow along on this scroll in a gallery in order to read. You cannot read by just standing in one spot. You have to toggle side by side, up and down, around corners, because they're so sculptural. This one is less that, but you still have to move in and out if you do make the decision to actually spend the time and read these. And when you read certain ones, if you move in to read these, the text on the other disappears. Mm. So it is a kind of form of reading where the viewer has to come in. If they want access to the words, they can move in and out and have a different experience of the paper. And the shadows are really important, and they're part of, I think they're a kind of text in a way, as well as the paper. What's also important about the little perforated pieces that are on the floor is that they echo the cast ladder and the boxes.
So yes, we've got a sculptural element here. We've got two open boxes in the shape of cardboard boxes and a ladder that's kind of hovering in the air.
That's right.
And these are made out of paper as well.
Yeah, so these are ginwashi, which are Japanese papers. They're very, very, very strong, but they look fragile. They're translucent. You can see through them. So I purchased a ladder, and one of my colleagues, you know, picked it up in Niagara Falls and brought it to my studio for me. And so I cast this old wooden ladder. It was really falling apart. The rungs were, you know, I had to re-glue them. And so covered the ladder in plastic and then cast this rice paper over the ladder in two sections. So the ladder, I actually tried a ladder a few years ago. I had a cast ladder where I printed words on them, but I fabricated the ladder. And to me, it didn't work. It looked like a facsimile of a ladder or a symbolic reference of a ladder. Instead of, I wanted it to be very clearly a ladder that was used but is no longer able to have its function.
So these rungs, like, they're not like perfectly square or perfectly circular. Like, they're they've got like kind of indents and curves to them, which would have been
from the casting.
From somebody using the ladder going up and down, and then when you cast it, that erosion is.
Well, it's more to do with. I mean, the rungs were in pretty cruddy shape for sure, the wooden ones. But that's part of just the casting. Because it's paper, as soon as you remove the form of the paper from the ladder, you don't have the solid substrate underneath. So, you know, it is subject to having flaws and imperfections, which I'm very interested in. This particular paper, which is also Ginwashi Mitsumata, has these little fibers in it. And the fibers sometimes stick out when I was casting them, and I loved, again, that materials having a say, asserting themselves, I guess. So you can really tell that that ladder is made up of these fibrousy particles, and when casting them, sometimes they would pull themselves off, or if they were at the edge of a paper and the paper had been torn, the filament would stay intact, and that kind of laciness around parts of the ladder. But I also want it to be about ascension, but you can't actually ascend on this ladder. It's hovering above, it's not going anywhere, and if you actually tried to stand on that ladder, it would...
And we don't encourage anyone to climb on artwork.
We don't encourage anyone to go on this artwork.
But you wouldn't be able to.
But you couldn't be able to, and I think recognizing that it's paper. And the same thing with these boxes. So they actually were cast boxes. So I brought a box, a carton to my studio that I had moved some of my stuff to St. Catharines, and I cast the box, including the handles. Yeah, including the handles. And it's the same. It's two layers of paper, a Ginwashi and then a Ginwashi Mitsumata. And the idea of them, again, being, well, you put all your stuff in, and a lot of times you're packing up a home of someone who's no longer with us. You pack up these things in boxes, or you move. So the idea of moving from one place to another, which is what some people say the journey of afterlife is, only these boxes are not really able to effectively carry anything. There's nothing in them. And so they're positioned here as sort of ghostly boxes, or maybe they're after boxes.
Well, yeah, you've got me thinking. You've got me thinking a whole bunch of different thoughts from my own experiences here as well with boxes and moving. And moving can sometimes be the beginning of something, but it's also the end of things and kind of, what do you do, you know, when somebody's gone, what do you do with all their stuff?
Right.
Like that big question that we all face at some point with somebody.
Yeah. I did a previous series many years ago called A Date with Death, and it was still figurative work, but a lot of the figures, the characters in there, had suitcases tied to their bodies that they were dragging around, like endless lines of suitcases. That's sort of how we carry all of our baggage with us, but also they are part of a journey. They same with boxes, and you're right, they get packed, they have a start and an end point, so...
And their location here and how you have them set up has me thinking about, you know, the old adage, you can't take it with you, right? Like, here's the boxes, there's the ladder. It's almost as though somebody kind of came to the ladder and was like, oh, okay, well, gotta leave the boxes behind.
Right. Yeah, it is. I mean, the ladder is no longer serving the purpose that a ladder would serve.
Yeah.
And so it is this ghostly shell of a ladder. It's not fit for climbing. It's not even positioned in potential to climb. It's suspended and unable to really service us in any way. And so, these are equated to bodies for me as well.
I also see it though as metaphorical, as that transition from the earth to something above, which we don't see, but again, as you said, like a physical body could not climb that.
Right. Yes, and definitely it is ascension. And I've actually wanted to, as I said, I had a piece with a ladder years ago, and I was not satisfied with it and never pursued it. But there is something about the ladder that I love, the symbol of the ladder, and climbing, and not in the sense of a corporate, although it's interesting, somebody told me they came in and their husband, who's in finance, said, oh, that's the corporate ladder, and you climb it, and it kills you. And I thought, that's a great interpretation. It's not my intention, but it's a great interpretation, because that's the example of somebody bringing their own experience to the work, which is really important.
Yeah, so I want to ask you a little bit more, because as we've talked, I've kind of shared some of my interpretations and what I'm seeing in the work. A listener who's seen the exhibit could see something different. Obviously, as you said, this gentleman saw something different from what you intended. What is it like as an artist when you create a piece or you create a show and you kind of have your ideas, and then somebody comes in with something that's completely off the wall? How does that feel as an artist? How do you respond to that?
Yeah.
Do artists enjoy hearing that kind of thing in general? I mean, I suppose we can't really generalize, but, you know, what's the artist's reaction?
It's really interesting, because it's something that I talk to a lot with my students about. And if everybody comes in and you're saying, my work is about this, it's about losing consciousness. I'm just using an example, and everybody else says, actually, I see this as about playing hockey or something. If people are coming in and saying it's just not reading that way at all, then, you know, the sort of problem they need to solve is it the materials? Is it the way that they're using their imagery or iconography or objects? Not getting that across? Do they need to shift how they're building it, the scale? All of those things are part of what you think about when you're training as an artist. Like, maybe it's too small and I need to go larger. Maybe it's too large and I need to make it postage size stamps so that people come up and have an intimate experience with it. So those are all considerations that you have to make in the studio. After that, though, once I've decided, I know I want these to show my physicalized body, I want them to acknowledge that the materials have a language of their own, I want the text to operate in different ways, and also understand that the text are my extracts and my thoughts, and people will interpret them differently. After all of that, people are going to come and take, everybody's positionality means they're going to come and take away something different. So that's where the associations, the connotations can come in. So I had a piece years ago that was suspended over a wall, and it was on honeycomb paper. So when I printed it onto the honeycomb paper, hand printed it, and the letters would disappear between the spaces in the honeycomb, and then I undulated them. I stiffened them with a fabric stiffener and undulated. Then I positioned them across, up and down on a wall. And I put together phrases from anatomical books, literary texts. I'm trying to remember what the other sources were. So it was this kind of a bricolage of text, almost, in a way. And the bottom one was, my mother said to pick the very best one, and you are not it. And one of the people that was viewing this piece started at the top, and he read over and over again. He said as the more he started to read, the more he began to dance and play with the text. But when he hit the bottom, he sunk down, because he said the weight of that, my mother said to pick the very best one and you are not it. He said it was really heavy. It hit him for the first time about what that text actually meant, which was about exclusion, right? So that was a really interesting, or the reference of the person who told me they became the punctuation within the piece, how they moved about it. So for me, those kinds of subjective viewpoints that people bring in, experiences, I think are really important. And for me, when people write about my work, if curators write about my work or reviewers write about my work, and they kind of add meaning in a way, it's saying, here's the objects that I've made, here's the forms that I've made, now they're out of this space. But the text lives on, and how people viewed or interpreted that text. And usually people are gaining the sort of, truthfully, they're gaining the essence of it. I made a 13-foot rice paper tower that folded into itself, almost like a Chinese yo-yo, where I took out the doweling and it could collapse. So I actually was able to take it to an exhibition in Michigan on a plane in a wardrobe box, which was great. So it traveled with me in a snowstorm, and we got there and I set it up. And it had circles of text, and people read it as Tower of Babel, which was exactly right. And other people read it as Ivory Tower, because it did have privileged texts of anatomical references. So all of those were right. There's nothing that was wrong. I know what I'm intending to do, but I also am aware that when I put them out there, the meaning extends. And I think that's a good thing.
So it sounds like as an artist, you have to be willing to kind of let it go, like kind of set it out in the world, and you know what it means to you, but you have to kind of say, figure out what it means to you.
Right. I mean, I think if somebody came in and had a read that was so far off, I'd think, what the heck? but yes, I think for me, when people come, and there's going to be lots of people who walk in, look around, and walk out. And as an artist, you just know it's not going to engage everybody. And then there are people that are going to engage with it in different ways. Some people are going to walk around and experience the color, or experience the scale, or experience the sculptural pieces more than the paper pieces. They may also be more fixated on the words. And so it's okay how people experience it, but I think I mentioned that I really initially wanted these to be, I was going to be really confessional and like, oh, this is what I'm facing. And at some point I got in and went, well, there's not words that are adequate, right? Mm-hmm. I can't construct a set of words. I haven't written a novel that somebody could sit down and I'm going to make them cry. I've provided these extracts of my thoughts about this subject and tried to impress myself within them in many, many different ways. And in the end, if somebody comes and gets an experience out of it, it's great. But I know that people are going to, each person's going to have a different experience of this. And in a way, I would argue that is what language is, right? Mm. And it is very, even though we can agree on a meaning of a word and we can look up the dictionary definition, there are people that are going to have a different connotation of that word, or a different subjective association or familial association. And I love those things about language and about art.
So you mentioned people coming. So what kind of tip or what kind of insight, like for somebody who maybe hasn't been to a gallery before or is very intimidated by the idea of coming to a gallery, who kind of walks in and it's like, what does this mean? Like, how do I figure out what it means, or like, yeah. This is, what kind of tips would you have for somebody?
It's a very interesting question. I used to work in a rural art gallery, and we would have, you know, really, really wonderful shows by contemporary artists. And some of the content was a little challenging, and some people would walk in the door and not even enter. They would stand at the doorway and look around and go, no. So part of the key is making people understand you don't have to understand everything. Not everything needs to be explained away. It's not like paintings that were commissioned by the church where this symbol meant this, this symbol meant this. If you put a monkey in, it was, you know, unbridled passion. And so if you put it on a chain, it was showing that you had to restrain, there had to be restraint. So we're at a point now where we understand that, you know, we're hoping to open meanings and invite that. So I think the thing would be making a welcoming space for people, letting them come in and explore at their own time. But I also am an advocate of artist talks. I know that art can be, even for people who are working in research areas that are, you know, very in-depth and that are related to visual culture, sometimes I've seen even in examinations where, you know, for master's examinations where they don't actually want to speak about the work. They want to speak about a paper that accompanies the work, mm-hmm. the scholarly text or the written text that that addresses some of the meanings within the work for the student. So it's interesting, and I always advocate artist talks because I love hearing how artists start a project, how they do the research within that project, how they envision it going, how they then get the funding together to get it to go, and then how they put it, you know, how it comes out and always comes out a little differently than they expected because of either limitations or because of really great experimentations, which then opened up other ways of doing it. And so I always encourage people to listen to those because I think even if you don't initially quote-unquote like the work, I think you gain insight into how much attention goes into contemporary artworks particularly and how much people think about what they're doing and how they're placing it together. I think it's great to come in, and if you look in and you're a little intimidated, read the statement on the wall, either the curator's statement or the artist's statement, and then see if that provides a sort of a foray in, because really sometimes it just takes one thing to tug somebody in, and then when that thing pulls them in, and the longer they look, the more other meanings come to them. And I think really that is the key, is looking at art. It's spending time with art and then having all of these other things kind of unfold and let them unfold. Don't discount anything. You know, you can be in front of work and start to make your own connections. And even if you go away and say, well, I didn't like that show, if you spent time with it and you thought about it, I think it's a great thing. Yeah,
I think that time aspect is really important. This is my second time in this exhibit. I just had a quick peek before, so I wasn't able to spend a lot of time when I first saw it. But certainly, I'm seeing things even now, just since the time we've been recording. I'm kind of seeing shapes, or I'm seeing textures, or things are striking me a little bit different than they did when I first saw them. And so being able to spend a bit of time and kind of let the artwork speak to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And I was in a Bill Viola retrospective at the Whitney many years ago now. And I was standing there with my companion, and we were in the middle of four screens, a piece that was where he was talking really, really fast and mumbling, and all of these images going really quickly. And we watched people walk in and spend 2 seconds in that arena that Bill Viola had created, and then walk out, and others walk in and kind of look and walk out. And we were there for about 25 minutes, and the more we were there, the more we started to be able to discern what was being said on the audio, and then we started to put the audio together with the video. And it really is about not forcing yourself, but allowing yourself the time to spend with a piece.
There are many other shows that you've got lined up. Are you able, here at the NYW Gallery, are you able to give us any sneak peeks into what else is coming up?
There is a show that's following this one, which is by Laurie Morrison, who's actually a librarian here on campus and also a student. And they're doing plant-based photography, so developing photographs with plant-based material that are harvested often from their garden. That's coming up next. And there are some alumni who will be showing as well, who are doing joint shows from alumni. So this space is really for faculty, students, alumni, invited community. And there are times during the year where there's a call for students anywhere on campus to apply, and there are sometimes calls for anyone in the community to apply and be part of a group show, and if you're selected, they would be placed in the gallery.
Fantastic.
Here. Yeah.
We will put some links in the show notes.
The Honors Thesis exhibition is always kind of mid-April, and that takes place here at the Marilyn I. Walker exhibition space, but also at Niagara Artist Center. So they split the exhibition between the two venues, which is great. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. And that's always some great top-notch art. Mm-hmm. I have pieces from past exhibitions that still kind of stick in my mind. Really creative work. So I always look forward to seeing what the students have spent the past 4 years working on, or working towards, I guess I should say. I'll mention as well that the gallery is not open all day every day, but we will put a link in the show notes to gallery times and what's coming up so that folks can find that out. But this school is part of Brock University campus. It's beautiful, beautiful facilities. I always love coming down here. It's a renovated 19th century haircloth factory, kind of in the heart of St. Catharines, and they've incorporated some of those, or retained some of those industrial touches along with some very modern facilities. So students are always welcome, and Now, I've heard you give a number before of roughly how many events between visual arts, music, and dramatic arts.
And Center for Studies and Arts and Culture.
Center for Studies and Arts and Culture. Yeah. How many events are going on here?
Yeah, between September and the end of May, we generally have between 70 and 75 events, sometimes more. And that is exhibitions, performances, recitals, lectures, and workshops.
So. Excellent. So there's got to be something for everybody.
Absolutely.
At some point. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Allison, for
sharing your process and talking about this and getting me thinking about so many things. this is really beautiful. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you. And I really appreciate your insights. So that's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Forward. Find our footnotes, links to more information, transcripts, and past episodes on our website, brocku.ca/humanities. We love to hear from our listeners, so join us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @brockhumanities. Please subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcasting app so you don't miss an episode. Forward is hosted and produced by Allison Innes for the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University. Sound editing is by Serena Atella, and theme music is by Kalida Mam. This podcast is financially supported by the Faculty of Humanities at Brock University.